the door, and looking to see what had caused it, I saw George Sorrell come in. It was apparent at a glance that the tavern owner had been availing himself of his own wares, possibly as a means of getting up his courage, for he stood swaying slightly, fists clenched at his sides, looking slowly round the room, belligerently meeting the stares that greeted him. Jamie said something very unsuitable in a house of God, under his breath in Gaelic, and started toward the door. Before he could reach it, though, Fergus had turned to see the cause of the stir, and had spotted Sorrell. Fergus was no more sober than Sorrell, but was much more upset. He stiffened for an instant, then pulled himself free of the grasping hands of his supporters, and headed for Sorrell without a word, red-eyed as a hunting ferret, and just as dangerous. He hit Sorrell with his fist as the man was opening his mouth. Unsteady as they were, both of them staggered from the impact, and men rushed in to separate them. Jamie reached Sorrell, and grabbing his arm, jerked him out of the scrum.
"I suggest that you leave, sir," he said politely, under the circumstances,
and turned the man firmly toward the door.
"Don't,"
Fergus said. He was breathing like a train, sweat pouring down his chalk-white face.
"Don't go. Stay and tell me why. Why have you come here? How dare you come here?"
This last was uttered in a cracked shout that made Sorrell blink and take a step backward. He shook his head doggedly, though, and drew himself up.
"I came to offer Mrs. Fraser to say I was sorry about her son," he said sullenly. "And you ain't a-gonna stop me either, you farting French son of a bitch." "You offer my wife nothing," Fergus said, shaking with fury. "Nothing, do you hear? Who is to say you did not set the fire yourself? To kill me? To seize upon my wife? Salo."
I would have bet money that Sorrell didn't know what a salo was, but it didn't matter. He went the colour of beetroot and lunged at Fergus. He didn't reach him, as Jamie managed to grab his collar, but there was a sound of rending cloth, and Sorrell jerked to a stop, staggering. There was a rumble through the room, men and women gathering in a thundercloud of disapproval. I could see Jamie drawing himself up and in, settling himself to haul Sorrell out before someone besides Fergus took a swing at him. A certain shuffling readiness suggested that a number of men had it in mind. And then Rachel walked between the two men. She was very pale, though a red spot burned in each cheek, and her hands were clenched in the fabric of her skirt. "Does thee indeed come to offer comfort, friend?" she said to Sorrell, in a voice that shook only a little. "For if that is so, thee ought to offer it to all of those who are met here for the sake of the child. Particularly to his father." She turned toward Fergus, reaching to put a careful hand on his sleeve. "Thee will not see thy wife distressed further, I know," she said quietly. "Will thee not go to her now? For while she is grateful for the presence of so many kind folk, it is only thee she wants." Fergus's face worked, anguish and fury warring with confusion. Seeing him unable to decide what to do or how to do it, Rachel moved closer and took his arm, tucking her hand into the curve of his elbow, and compelled him to turn and walk with her, the crowd parting in front of them. I saw the curve of Masali's blonde head as she raised it slowly, her face changing as she watched Fergus come. Jamie took a deep breath and released Sorrell.
"Well," he said quietly, "stay or go, as you will."
Sorrell was still panting a little, but he had himself in hand now. He nodded jerkily, drew himself up, and straightened his torn coat. Then he walked through the silent crowd, head up, to give his sympathies to the bereaved. Chapter 122. Hallowed Ground. In spite of the neighbour's generosity, there was very little to pack, nor was there any reason to linger in Philadelphia. Our life there was ended.
There was, there always is, considerable speculation as to the cause of the fire.
But after the outburst at the wake, a sense of flat finality had settled over all of us. The neighbours would continue to talk, but among the family there was an unspoken agreement that it made little difference whether the fire had been pure accident or someone's ill design. Nothing would bring Henri Christian back. Nothing else mattered. Jamie had taken Fergus to make the arrangements for our travel, not because he needed assistance, but as a way of keeping Fergus moving, lest he simply sit down by Henri Christian's small coffin and never rise again. Things were both easier and harder for Massali. She had children to care for, children who needed her badly. Rachel and I packed what there was to pack, bought food for the journey, and dealt with the final details of leaving. I packed the bits and bobs of my surgery, and with mutual tears and embraces, gave the keys of number 17 Chestnut Street to Mrs. Fig. And in the early afternoon of the day following the wake, we borrowed a small cart, hitched up Clarence, and followed Henri Christian to his grave. There hadn't been any discussion as to the burial. After the wake, Ian had simply stood up and said,
"I know where he must rest."
It was a long way, perhaps 2 hours' walk outside the city. The heat had broken at last, though, and the air moved gently over us with the first cool touch of autumn. There was no ceremony to our procession, no Gallic laments for a life cut short, no professional wailing, only a small family walking together for the last time. We left the road at Ian's signal. Jamie unhitched Clarence and hobbled him to graze. Then he and Fergus lifted the coffin and followed Ian into the whisper of the trees, along a small and hidden path made by the hooves of deer, and so upward to a small clearing in the forest. There were two large cairns there, knee-high, and a smaller one at the edge of the clearing, under the branches of a red cedar. A flat stone lay against it, the word Rollo scratched into it. Fergus and Jamie set down the little coffin, gently. Joni and Felicite had stopped crying during the long walk, but seeing it there, so small and forlorn, facing the thought of walking away, they began to weep silently, clinging hard to each other. And at the sight of them, grief rose in me like a fountain. Germaine was holding hard to his mother's hand, mute and jaw-set, tearless. Not seeking support, giving it, though the agony showed clear in his eyes as they rested on his brother's coffin. Ian touched Masali's arm gently.
"This place is hallowed by my sweat and my tears, cousin," he said softly. "Let us hallow it also by our blood, and let our wee lad rest here safe in his family. If he cannot go with us, we will abide with him."
He took the skean dhu from his stocking and drew it across his wrist lightly, then held his arm above Henri Christian's coffin, letting a few drops fall on the wood. I could hear the sound of it, like the beginning of rain. Massali drew a shattered breath, stood straight, and took the knife from his hand. Part 8. Search and Rescue. Chapter 123. Quod Scripsi, Scripsi. From Mrs. Abigail Bell, Savannah, the Royal Colony of Georgia, to Mr. James Fraser, Philadelphia, Colony of Pennsylvania. Dear Mr. Fraser, I write in response to yours of the 17th inst, apprising my husband of your return to America, which was forwarded to him by a friend in Wilmington. As you will see from the direction of this letter, we have removed from Wilmington to Savannah, the political climate of North Carolina having become increasingly dangerous to loyalists, particularly to my husband, given his history and profession. I wish to assure you that your press has been preserved in excellent condition, but is not presently in use. My husband contracted a serious ague soon after our arrival here, and it became evident that his illness was of the periodic or relapsing kind. He does somewhat better these days, but is unable to sustain the difficult labour of the printing trade. I will add, should you think of establishing a business here, that while the politics of the place are a great deal more congenial to those of the loyalist persuasion than those of the northern colonies, a printer is exposed to much unpleasantness, whatever his personal beliefs. Your press is presently stored in the barn of a farmer named Simpson, who lives a short distance outside the city. I have seen it and assured myself that the instrument is clean, dry, it is packed in straw, and sheltered from the weather. Please apprise me of your desires should you wish me to sell the press and forward the money to you, or should you wish to come and fetch it. We are most appreciative of your help and kindness, and the girls pray for you and your family every day. Yours, most sincerely, Abigail Bell. William Ransom to His Grace Harold, Duke of Pardlow, September 24th, 1778. Dear Uncle Hal, you will be gratified to know that your paternal instinct was correct. I'm very pleased to tell you that Ben probably isn't dead. On the other hand, I haven't the slightest idea where the devil he is or why he's there. I was shown a grave at Middlebrook Encampment in New Jersey, purported to be Ben's, but the body therein is not Ben. It's probably better if you don't know how that bit of information was ascertained. Clearly, someone in the Continental Army must know something of his whereabouts, but most of Washington's troops who were at the encampment when he was captured have gone. There is one man who might possibly yield some information, but beyond that, the only possible connection would seem to be the captain with whom we are acquainted. I propose, therefore, to hunt the gentleman in question and extract what information he may possess when I find him. Your most obedient nephew, William. Lord John Grey to Harold, Duke of Pardlow, Charleston, South Carolina, September 28th, 1778.
Dear Hal, we arrived in Charleston by ship 2 days ago, having encountered a storm off the Chesapeake that blew us out to sea, delaying us for several days. I'm sure you will not be surprised in the least to learn that Dotty is a much better sailor than I am. She also shows promise as an inquiry agent. First thing this morning she discovered the whereabouts of Aramanthus Cowden by the simple expedient of stopping a well-dressed lady on the street, admiring her gown, and then asking for the names of the better dressmakers in the city, on the assumption, as she later explained to me, that Ben would not have married either a plain woman or one with no interest in fashion. The third shop we visited did indeed boast that Miss Cowden, she was calling herself Mrs. Grey, they said, but they knew her maiden name, as she was residing with an aunt named Cowden, was a customer, and they were able to describe her to me as a slight young woman of middle height, with an excellent complexion, large brown eyes, and abundant hair of a dark blonde hue. They could not, however, give me her address, as the lady had recently decamped to winter with friends in Savannah. The aunt has annoyingly died, I find. Interestingly, she styles herself as a widow, so apparently she was informed, and by whom, I should like to know, of Ben's presumed death, sometime after the date of her letter to you, as otherwise she would certainly have mentioned it. I also find it interesting that she should be able to afford the services of Madame Eulalie, and these to no little extent. I succeeded in inducing Madame to show me her recent bills, when her letter to you professed her to be in financial difficulties owing to Ben's capture. If Ben is indeed dead, and both the death and the marriage proved, then presumably she would inherit some property, or at least the child would. But she can't possibly have taken such legal steps in the time between her letter to you and the present. It could easily take that long merely to send a letter to London, assuming that she had any idea to whom it should be sent, and assuming also that whoever received it would not immediately have informed you. Oh, she does possess an infant, a boy, and the child is hers. Madame made her 2 gowns and a set of stays to accommodate the pregnancy. Naturally, there is no telling whether Benjamin is the child's father. She clearly has at least met Ben, or possibly Adam. She could have got Wattiswade from anyone in the family, but that's not proof of either marriage or paternity. All in all, an interesting woman, your putative daughter-in-law. Plainly, our path lies now towards Savannah,
though this may require somewhat more investigative effort, as we don't know the name of the friends with whom she's taken refuge. And if she is indeed poverty-stricken, she won't be buying new gowns. I hope to convince Dotty that she need not accompany me. She's most determined, but I can see that she pines for her Quaker physician, and if our quest should be greatly prolonged, I will not allow her to be placed in danger, I assure you. Your most affectionate brother, John. General Sir Henry Clinton, Commander-in-Chief for North America, to Colonel His Grace Duke of Pardlow, 46th Foot. Sir, you are hereby ordered and directed to assemble and refit your troops, in whatever manner you deem necessary, and then to make junction with Lieutenant Colonel Archibald Campbell to march upon the city of Savannah in the colony of Georgia, and take possession of it in His Majesty's name. H. Clinton.
Harold, Duke of Pardlow, felt his chest tightening and rang for his orderly.
"Coffee, please," he said to the man. "Brewed very strong and quickly. And bring the brandy while you're at it."
Chapter 124. Brought to you by the letters Q, E, and D. It was, of course, unthinkable that we should sell Clarence. "Do you think he weighs as much as a printing press?" I asked, looking at him dubiously. His tiny stable next to the shop had survived the fire, and while he wrinkled his nose and sneezed when the wind raised a whiff of ash from the charred remains of the print shop, he didn't seem much affected.
"Substantially more, I think."
Jamie scratched his forehead and ran a hand up the length of one long ear.
"Do you think mules suffer from seasickness?"
"Can they vomit?" I tried to recall whether I'd ever seen a horse or mule regurgitate, as opposed to dropping slobbery mouthfuls or whatever they were eating, but couldn't call an instance to mind.
"I couldn't see if they can,"
Jamie said, picking up a stiff brush and beating clouds of dust from Clarence's broad grey back.
"But they don't. No."
"Then how would you know if a mule was seasick?"
Jamie himself got violently seasick,
and I did wonder how he was going to manage if we did go by ship. The acupuncture needles I used to quell his nausea had perished in the fire, with so much else. Jamie gave me a jaundiced look over Clarence's back.
"Can you not tell if I'm seasick, even when I'm not puking?"
"Well, yes," I said mildly. "But you aren't covered with hair, and you can talk. You turn green and pour with sweat and lie about groaning and begging to be shot."
"Aye. Well, barring the turning green, a mule can tell you very well if he's feeling peely-wally. And he can certainly make you want to shoot him."
He ran a hand down Clarence's leg to pick up the mule's left front hoof. Clarence picked it up and set it down again very solidly, exactly where Jamie's own foot had been an instant before. His ears twitched.
"On the other hand," Jamie said to him, "a good mate you walk all the way to Savannah, pulling a cart behind you. Think about that, aye?"
He came out of the stall and closed the gate, shaking it to be sure it was securely latched.
"Mr. Fraser!"
A shout from the end of the alley drew his attention. It was Jonas Phillips, presumably on his way home to a midday dinner from the assembly room where the Continental Congress was still locked in struggle. Jamie waved back and, with a nod to me, walked down the alley. While I waited for him, I turned my attention to the jumble of items occupying the other half of the stable. What little room there was, besides Clarence's stall, was filled with the things the neighbours had managed to salvage from the remains of the print shop. All of it had the sour reek of ash about it, but a few of the items might be salvaged, or sold, I supposed. Mrs. Bell's letter had caused a certain re-evaluation of our immediate prospects. Fergus's press had definitely perished in the flames. The derelict carcass was still there, the metal parts twisted in a way suggesting uncomfortably that the thing had died in agony. Fergus hadn't wept. After Henri Christian, I didn't think anything could ever make him weep again. But he did avert his eyes whenever he came near the ruins. On the one hand, the loss of the press was terrible. But on the other, It did save us the problem of hauling it to...
Well, that was another problem.
Where were we going? Jamie had assured me that we were going home, back to the Ridge. But it was late September, and even if we found the money to pay the passage for so many people and Clarence, and were fortunate enough not to be sunk or captured by an English cutter, we would part company with Fergus and Massali in Wilmington, then go up the Cape Fear River into the North Carolina backcountry, leaving Massali, Fergus, and the children to go on alone to Savannah. I knew that Jamie didn't want to do that. In all honesty, neither did I. The little family was surviving, but there was no doubt that Henri Christian's death and the fire had left them all badly wounded, especially Germain. You could see it in his face, even in the way he walked, no longer jaunty and bright-eyed, eager for adventure. He walked with his shoulders hunched, as though expecting a blow to come out of nowhere. And while sometimes he would forget for a few minutes and revert to his normal swagger and talk, you could see it when the blow of memory did come out of nowhere to send him reeling. Ian and Rachel had taken it upon themselves to be sure that he didn't slink away by himself. One or the other was always calling on him to come and help carry the marketing, or go out to the forest to look for the proper wood for an axe handle or a new bow. That helped. If Fergus went to Savannah to retrieve Bonnie, Jamie's original press, Massali would be hampered and preoccupied by advancing pregnancy, and the difficulties both of travel with a family and then of establishing a new home, Fergus needing to devote himself to setting up the new business and dealing with whatever the local politics might be. Germain could so easily slip through the cracks in his family and be lost. I wondered whether Jenny would go with them, or with Ian and Rachel. Massali could certainly use her help, but I remembered what Massali had said and thought she was right. Ian's her youngest, and she's had too little of him. She had. Ian had essentially been lost to her at the age of 14, and she hadn't seen him again until he was a grown man. And a mohawk. I'd seen her now and then, gazing at him as he talked and ate, with a small inward glow on her face. I poked gingerly through the pile of remnants. Masali's cauldron had survived unscathed, though covered with soot. A few pewter plates, one half melted, the wooden ones had all burned, and a stack of Bibles, rescued from the front room by some pious soul. A line of washing had been hung out across the alley. What clothes were on it had all survived, though a couple of Fergus's shirts and Joni's pinafore had been badly singed. I supposed boiling with lye soap might get the stink of fire out of the clothes, but I doubted that any of the family would wear them again. Clarence, having finished his hay, was methodically rubbing his forehead against the top rail of his gate, making it rattle and thump. "Itchy, are you?" I scratched him, then poked my head out of the stable. Jamie was still in conversation with Mr. Phillips at the mouth of the alley, though, and I went back to my explorations. Under a pile of smoke-stained playscripts, I found Masali's small chiming clock, somehow miraculously intact. It had stopped, of course, but emitted one small, sweet silver bing when I picked it up, making me smile. Perhaps that was a good omen for the journey. After all, even if Jamie and I and Rachel and Ian were to set out at once for Fraser's Ridge, there was no chance of reaching the mountains of North Carolina before snow had closed the passes for the winter. It would be March, at the earliest, before we could turn inland. I sighed, clock in hand, envisioning the ridge in springtime. It would be a good time to arrive, the weather good for planting and building. I could wait. I heard Jamie's steps come down the cobbled alley and stop. Stepping to the open front of the stable, I saw that he'd paused at the place where Henri Christian had died. He stood unmoving for a moment, then crossed himself and turned. The solemnity left his face as he saw me, and he held up a small leather bag, smiling.
"Luke Sassenach."
"What is it?"
"One of the Phillips boys found it, scavenging about, and brought it to his father." "Hold out your hands."
Puzzled, I did so, and he tilted the bag, decanting a small cascade of surprisingly heavy, dark grey chunks of lead. The type for a complete set of...
I picked one out and squinted at it.
Castlan English Roman?
Better than that, Sassenach,
he said, and, plucking the letter Q from the pile in my hand, he dug his thumbnail into the soft metal, revealing a faint yellow gleam.
Masali's hoard.
My God, it is! I'd forgotten all about it. At the height of the British occupation, when Fergus had been obliged to leave home to avoid arrest, sleeping in a different place each night, Masali had cast a set of type in gold, carefully rubbing each slug with grease, soot, and ink, and had carried the pouch under her apron, in case she and the children should be likewise forced to flee.
So did Masali, I expect.
His smile faded a bit, thinking of the causes of Masali's distraction.
She'd buried it under the bricks of the Huff, I suppose, when the army left. Sam Phillips found it when they were pulling down the chimney.
He nodded toward the charred spot where the print shop had stood. The chimney had been damaged by the wall falling in, so a number of men had taken it down, neatly stacking the bricks, most of which were intact despite the fire, and could be sold. I poured the type carefully back into the pouch and glanced over my shoulder at Clarence. I suppose a goldsmith could make me a set of really big acupuncture needles, just in case. Chapter 125.
Squid of the evening. Beautiful squid.
Charleston, Royal Colony of South Carolina. Lord John and his niece Dorothea ate that night at a small ordinary near the shore, whose air was redolent with the luscious scents of baked fish, eels in wine sauce, and small whole squid, fried crisply in cornmeal. John inhaled deeply with pleasure, handed Dotty to a stool, and sat down himself, enjoying the moment of gustatory indecision.
It's that moment when you can convincingly imagine the delightful prospect of eating everything the establishment has to offer, he told Dotty, momentarily untroubled by the knowledge that one's stomach has a limited capacity, and thus one must, alas, choose in the end.
Dotty looked a little dubious, but thus urged, she took a deep sniff of the atmosphere, to which the scent of fresh-baked bread had just been added, as the serving maid came in with a great loaf and a dish of butter with a four-leafed clover, this being the name of the establishment, stamped into its oleaginous surface.
"Oh, that smells wonderful," she said, her face lighting. "Might I have some, please? And a glass of cider?"
He was pleased to see her nibble hungrily at the bread and take a deep breath of the cider, which was aromatic enough to challenge even the squid, his own reluctantly final choice, though this was accompanied by a dozen fresh-shucked oysters to fill whatever crevices might remain. Dotty had chosen the baked hake, though she'd only picked at it so far.
"I came down to the harbour this afternoon while you were resting," he said, tearing off a wadge of bread to counteract the grated horseradish mixed with the oyster's brine. "I asked about and found two or three small boats whose owners are not averse to a quick journey to Savannah."
"How quick?" she asked warily.
"It's little more than 100 miles by water," he said, shrugging in what he hoped was a casual manner. "Perhaps 2 days, with a good wind and fair weather."
"Hmm." Dotty cast a sceptical glance at the ordinary's shuttered window. The shutters trembled to a blast of rain and wind.
"It's October, Uncle John. The weather is seldom predictable."
"How do you know? Madam, might I have some vinegar for the squid?"
The proprietor's wife nodded, bustling off, and he repeated,
"How do you know?"
"Our landlady's son is a fisherman. So was her husband. He died in a gale last October,"
she finished sweetly, and popped the last bite of bread into her mouth.
"Such squeamish prudence is unlike you, Dotty," he remarked,
accepting the vinegar bottle from the proprietress and sousing his crisp squidlings.
"Oh, God," he said, chewing, "ambrosia. Here, have one."
He speared one with his fork and passed it across to her.
"Yes. Well,
She regarded the squid-laden fork with a distinct lack of enthusiasm.
How long would it take to travel overland?
Perhaps 4 or 5 days. Again, with good weather.
She sighed, lifted the squid to her mouth, hesitated, and then, with the air of a Roman gladiator facing an oncoming crocodile in the arena, put it into her mouth and chewed. She went white. Dotty! He leapt up, knocking his stool over, and managed to catch her as she wilted toward the floor.
Gah!
She said faintly, and lunging out of his arms, bolted for the door, retching. He followed, and was in time to hold her head as she lost the bread, cider, and the half-chewed squid.
I'm so sorry, she said a few moments later, as he emerged from the ordinary with a mug and a damp cloth.
She was leaning against the most sheltered wall of the building, wrapped in his cloak, and was the colour of spoiled suet pudding.
How disgusting of me.
Think nothing of it, he said amiably. I've done just the same for all three of your brothers, on occasion, though I somehow doubt from the same cause. How long have you known you were with child?
I became certain of it about 5 minutes ago, she said,
swallowing audibly and shuddering.
Dear Lord, I will never eat squid again.
Have you ever eaten squid before?
No. I never want to see another squid. Bother. My mouth tastes of sick.
John, who was indeed experienced in such matters, handed her the mug of beer.
Rinse your mouth with that, he said. Then drink the rest. It'll settle your stomach.
She looked dubious at this, but did as he said, and emerged from the cup still pale but much improved.
Better?
Good.
I don't suppose you want to go back inside?
No, of course not.
Let me pay and I'll take you home.
Inside, he asked the landlady to make up a parcel of their abandoned supper. He didn't mind eating cold-fried squid, but he did want to eat. He was starving, and held this carefully to windward as they walked back to their lodgings.
You didn't know? He asked curiously. I've often wondered about that. Some women have told me they knew at once, and yet I've heard of others who somehow remained oblivious to their condition until the moment of birth was upon them. Incredible as that seems.
Dotty laughed. The cold wind had brought some of the colour back to her cheeks, and he was relieved to see her spirits recovered.
Do lots of women discuss their intimacies with you, Uncle John? That seems somewhat unusual.
I seem to attract unusual women, he said rather ruefully. I also seem to have the sort of face that people feel compelled to tell things to. In another age, perhaps I should have been a confessor, if that's the word. But returning to the point.
He took her elbow to guide her round a large pile of horse droppings.
And now that you do know, what shall we do about it?
I don't think anything actually needs to be done for about 8 months, she said.
And he gave her a look.
You know what I mean, he said. I doubt you wish to establish residence in Charleston till after your child arrives. Do you wish to return to Philadelphia? Or New Jersey? Or whatever godforsaken place Denzel happens to be at the moment. Or shall I make arrangements to proceed to Savannah and remain there for some time? Or...
Another thought struck him, and he altered the look to one of seriousness.
Do you want to go home, Dotty?
To England, I mean.
To your mother.
Her face went blank with surprise, which gave way to a look of longing that broke his heart. She looked away, blinking back tears, but her voice was steady when she turned back to him.
No, she said, and swallowed. I want to be with Denzel. All other considerations aside, she added, managing a smile, he knows how to deliver a baby. His cousin William is accoucheur to the Queen, and Denny studied with him for a time.
Well, that will be helpful,
Grey agreed rather dryly. He had himself delivered a child once, completely against his will, and still had nightmares about it. It was just as well that Dotty didn't want to return to England, though. He'd suggested the notion on impulse, but now realized that it might be more dangerous than any of the other alternatives. Since France had entered the war, all English shipping would be at risk.
I'm thinking that we ought to go to Savannah, though, Dotty was saying. We're so close, I mean. And if Ben's wife is there, she might need our help, mightn't she?
Yes, he agreed reluctantly. There was a familial obligation. And after all, unless he did take up residence in Charleston for the next 8 months, there seemed no alternative to Dotty's travelling in whichever direction.
Still, the thought of her giving birth here, him responsible for finding midwives and nurses, and then she and the child would need to be transported.
No, he said more definitely. Amaranthus, assuming she does exist, will have to muddle on by herself a little longer. I'm taking you back to New York.
Chapter 126. The Oglethorpe Plan. Late November. Savannah, unlike most American cities, had been carefully planned by its founder, a man named Oglethorpe. I knew this because Mrs. Landrum, the woman from whom we rented our room, had explained to me that the city was laid out according to the Oglethorpe Plan. This spoken in portentous tones, for Mrs. Landrum was a relative of the aforesaid Oglethorpe and intensely proud of the city and its civic perfection. The plan called for 6 wards, a ward being composed of 4 civic blocks for business and 4 tithing blocks for houses, these arrayed around an open square. There were 10 houses to a block, and the men of a tithing trained together for militia duty.
"Though that's not so important now as it used to be," Mrs. Landrum explained to me. "The Indians are still a bother in the back country, but it's years since they troubled to come into the city."
I rather thought Indians were the least of it, but as Mrs. Landrum didn't seem concerned about the war with the British, I didn't bring it up.
It was apparent from her references that as not only her family but everyone she knew were loyalists, plainly this was the proper state of things, and pesky nuisances like this rebellion, as they are pleased to call it, would soon be put down and we could get tea at a decent price again.
From my point of view, the most interesting thing about Mr. Oglethorpe's plan, in the course of conversation, it was revealed to me that he'd founded not only Savannah, but the whole province of Georgia, was that each house of a tithing was provided with a 1 mile tract of farmland outside the city and a 5 acre kitchen garden closer in.
Really? I said, my fingers beginning to itch at the thought of dirt. What do you plant?
The upshot of this conversation, and many like it, was that I made an arrangement to help with the keeping of the kitchen garden, in return for a share of sass, as Mrs. Landrum puzzlingly referred to green stuff like kale and turnips, beans and dried corn, as well as a small plot where I could cultivate medicinal herbs. A secondary consequence of this amiable acquaintance was that Rachel and Ian, whose room was below ours, began referring to their unborn child as Oglethorpe, though this was politely shortened to Oggie whenever Mrs. Landrum was in hearing. And the third and most important effect of Mrs. Landrum's friendship was that I found myself once more a doctor. We had been in Savannah for a few weeks when Mrs. Landrum came up to our room one afternoon and inquired as to whether I might know anything regarding cures for the toothache, she knowing that I had a way with herbs. "Oh, I might," I replied, with a surreptitious glance at my medical bag, which had been gathering dust under the bed since our arrival. "Whose tooth is it?" The tooth had belonged to a gentleman named Murphy from Ellis Ward, the one we lived in. I say had belonged, because I had the badly broken and infected bicuspid out of Mr. Murphy's head before he could have said Jack Robinson, though he was in such pain that he could barely recall his own name, let alone Jack's. Mr. Murphy was extremely grateful for his deliverance. Mr. Murphy was also the owner of a very small vacant shop on the other side of Ellis Square. It was the work of a few moments to acquire a small shingle with teeth extracted on it, and within 24 hours of hanging up my shingle, I was proudly depositing my earnings on the kitchen table, which was also my herbal preparations counter and Jamie's desk, as it occupied the centre of our single room.
Well done, Sassenach.
Jamie picked up a small jar of honey, taken in payment for a nastily impacted wisdom tooth. He loved honey. I'd also acquired 2 large speckled turkey eggs. One of them filled the entire palm of my hand. A loaf of reasonably fresh sourdough bread, 6 pennies, and a small silver Spanish coin.
I think you could support the family all on your own, Ian, he said, dipping a finger in the honey and licking it before I could stop him. Ian and Fergus and I can all retire and become gentlemen of leisure.
Good. You can start by making supper, I said, stretching my back. Stays did keep you upright through a long day's work, but I was looking forward to taking them off, eating supper, and lying down in quick succession.
Of course, Sassenach.
With a small flourish, he drew the knife from his belt, cut a slice off the loaf, drizzled honey on it, and gave it to me.
There you are.
I raised an eyebrow at him, but bit into it. Sweetness flooded my mouth and my bloodstream simultaneously, and I tasted sunlight and flowers. I moaned.
What did you say, Sassenach?
He was busily buttering another slice. I said, well done, I said, and picked up the pot of honey.
We'll make a cook of you yet.
The basic issues of housing and food taken care of, plainly the next order of business was to retrieve Bonnie. Jamie had located the Bell family, and 3 weeks after our arrival in Savannah, he and Fergus had scraped together enough money to hire a cart and an extra mule from the livery stable where Clarence boarded. We met Richard Bell in the morning, and he came with us to the farm of one Zachary Simpson, the farmer with whom Bonnie boarded. Mr. Simpson cleared away the last of the hay and pulled away the canvas with an air of a magician producing a rabbit from a hat. From the reaction of 3/4 of his spectators, you'd think he had. Jamie and Fergus both gasped audibly, and Richard Bell emitted a hum of satisfaction. I bit my lip and tried not to laugh, but I doubted they'd have noticed if I'd rolled on the floor in paroxysms of mirth.
Nom de Dieu, Fergus said, stretching out a reverent hand. She's beautiful. Best I've ever seen, Mr. Bell agreed, clearly torn between regard and regret. Aye.
Jamie was pink with pleasure, trying visibly to retain a modest constraint.
Aye, she's bonny, no?
I supposed she was, if one was a connoisseur of printing presses, which I wasn't. Still, I confess some fondness for Bonnie. We'd met before, in Edinburgh. Jamie had been oiling some part of her mechanism when I'd returned to find him after 20 years, and she had been witness to our reunion. And she had withstood the rigours of disassembly, sea travel, reassembly, and months of being immured in a barn with commendable fortitude. A pale winter sun shone through a crack in the barn's wall, making her wood glow with sombre pride, and her metal was, so far as I could see, quite free from rust. "Well done," I said, giving her a small pat. Mr. Simpson was modestly accepting the applause of the crowd for his feat of preserving Bonnie from harm, and I could see that they'd be some time in getting her onto the cart we'd brought. So I made my way back to the farmhouse. I noticed a number of chickens scratching in the yard and had some hopes of acquiring fresh eggs. Masali's hoard and Jenny's novena to St. Bride, Queen of the Sea, plus a modest assist from my acupuncture needles, Clarence luckily proved a good sailor, had got us safely to Savannah, but the requirements of housing 10 people and renting premises suitable for a small printing business had exhausted both the Caslon English Roman gold and the insurance money paid to Fergus for the fire's destruction. With the need for income somewhat acute, Ian and Jamie had found employment at one of the warehouses on the river. A wise choice, as it turned out. In addition to their pay and the odd damaged cask of salt fish or biscuit, being on the docks all day allowed them first and cheapest choice from the fishermen coming in with their catch. We therefore hadn't been starving, nor yet threatened with scurvy. The climate was mild enough that plenty of green things grew, even in late November. But I was getting tired of rice and fish and winter kale. A nice dish of scrambled eggs now, possibly with fresh butter. I'd come equipped for training with several packets of pins and a bag of salt, and Mrs. Simpson and I amicably concluded a bargain for a basket of eggs and a small tub of butter before the men had got Bonnie out of the barn and were sat on the back stoop, comfortably drinking beer. "What remarkable chickens those are," I said, stifling a small belch. The beer, of Mrs. Simpson's own production, was tasty but strong. The chickens in question were more than remarkable. They appeared to have no legs, but to be trundling round the yard on their bottom sides, pecking at their corn with cheerful imperturbability.
"Oh, aye," said Mrs. Simpson, nodding with pride. "My mother brought those. Well, they're great-great-grandmothers with her from Scotland 30 years agone. Creepies, she always called them, but they've got a true name. Scots Dumpy, it is. Or so a gentleman from Glasgow told me."
"How very appropriate," I said, taking another sip of beer and peering at the chickens.
"They did, after all, have legs. Just very short ones." "I breed them for sale," Mrs. Simpson added helpfully. "If, mate, should be, you should find yourself in want of a good hen or two."
"I can't think of anything I'd like better," I said wistfully.
The rice paddies and palmettos of savannas seemed infinitely far away from the clean, sharp air of Fraser's Ridge. But we were in the south at least, and come March and good travelling weather, Massali and Fergus should be safely established, and we could turn our faces toward North Carolina.
Perhaps in a few months.
I added Scott's Dumpy chickens to the mental list I was accumulating, and returned to the beer. The men had got the printing press onto the cart, suitably swathed in canvas, and repacked with straw for the journey into town, and now came into the house to resume their own well-earned refreshment. We sat companionably round Mrs. Simpson's scrubbed kitchen table, drinking beer and eating salted radishes. Jamie and Fergus were glowing with excitement and satisfaction. The looks on their faces warmed me more than the beer. Poor Richard Bell was trying his best to be generous and share their delight, but it was plain that he was low in both body and spirit. I had met him only a few days before, and that briefly, so had not yet cultivated an acquaintance sufficient to allow me to make him undress and let me palpate his liver. But I was morally certain that the relapsing ague Mrs. Bell had written of was malaria. I couldn't say so with complete certainty without looking at his blood cells under a microscope, and God knew when I might ever have one again. But I'd seen enough people suffering from the quartan ague or the tertian fever as to have little doubt. Luckily, I had a small supply of Jesuit bark among the selection of herbs and medicines I'd brought with me. It wouldn't cure him, but I could, with luck, limit the more severe attacks and relieve some of the symptoms. Thinking of this reminded me suddenly of Lizzie Weems. Coming to America as Brianna's bond servant, she also had contracted malaria from the coastal mosquitoes. I'd managed to control the disease in her fairly well. But how had she fared in my absence? "I'm sorry, what did you say?" My attention was jerked back to the conversation, but I added lots of Jesuit bark to my mental list before replying. Chapter 127. Plumbing. Like plumbing, medicine is a profession where you learn early on not to put your fingers in your mouth. I smelled my next patient coming and was reaching for the jar of soft soap and the bottle of raw alcohol before she came through the door. And the instant I saw her, I knew what the problem was. There were two women, in fact. One was a tall, rather commanding-looking woman, well-dressed and wearing a hat rather than the usual bonnet. The other was a small, slight girl who might have been any age between 12 and 20. She was what they called a mulatto, half black and half white,
with café au lait skin and snub features. I set her lower age limit at 12, only because she had apparent breasts bubbling over the top of her stays. She was dressed neatly but plainly in blue gingham, and she stank like an open sewer. The tall woman paused, looking me over consideringly.
"You are a female physician?"
she asked, in a tone just short of accusation.
"I am Dr. Fraser, yes,"
I replied equably. "And you are..." She flushed at that and looked disconcerted, also very dubious. But after an awkward pause, she made up her mind and gave a sharp nod.
"I am Sarah Bradshaw, Mrs. Philip Bradshaw."
"I'm pleased to meet you. And your companion?" I nodded at the young woman who stood with her shoulders hunched and her head bent, staring at the ground. I could hear a soft dripping noise, and she shifted as though trying to press her legs together, wincing as she did so.
"This is Sophronia, one of my husband's slaves."
Mrs. Bradshaw's lips compressed and drew in tight. From the lines surrounding her mouth, she did it routinely.
"She... that is... I thought... perhaps..."
Her rather plain face flamed crimson. She couldn't bring herself to describe the trouble. "I know what it is," I said, saving her the difficulty. I came round the table and took Sophronia by the hand. Hers was small and very calloused, but her fingernails were clean.
"A house slave, then?"
"What happened to the baby?" I asked her gently. A small, frightened intake of breath, and she glanced sideways at Mrs. Bradshaw, who gave her another sharp nod, lips still pursed.
"It died in me,"
the girl said so softly I could scarcely hear her, even though she was no more than an arm's length from me.
"They cut it out in pieces."
That had likely saved the girl's life, but it surely hadn't helped her condition. Despite the smell, I took a deep breath, trying to keep my emotions under control. "I'll need to examine Sophronia, Mrs. Bradshaw. If you have any errands, perhaps you'd like to go and take care of them." She unzipped her lips sufficiently as to make a small, frustrated noise. Quite obviously, she would like nothing better than to leave the girl and never come back. But just as obviously, she was afraid of what the slave might tell me if left alone with me. "Was the child your husband's?" I asked boldly. I didn't have time to beat around the bush. The poor girl was dripping urine and fecal matter on the floor and appeared ready to die of shame. I doubted that Mrs. Bradshaw meant to die of that condition, but she plainly felt it almost as acutely as did Sophronia. She went white with shock. Then her face flamed anew. She turned on her heel and stamped out, slamming the door behind her.
"I'll take that as a yes, then," I said to the door, and turned to the girl, smiling in reassurance. "Here, sweetheart, let's have a look at the trouble, shall we? Vesicovaginal fistula and rectovaginal fistula." I'd known that from the first moment. I just didn't know how bad they might be or how far up the vaginal canal they'd occurred. A fistula is a passage between two things that ought never to be joined and is, generally speaking, a bad thing. It wasn't a common condition in civilized countries in the 20th century, but more common than one might think. I'd seen it several times in Boston, at a clinic where I gave time once a week to provide medical care to the city's poor. Young girls, much too young to be considering the opposite sex in any serious way, becoming pregnant before their bodies had ripened enough. Prostitutes, some of them. Others, just girls who'd been in the wrong place at the wrong time. Like this one. A full-term baby that couldn't be forced out through the birth canal, and days of non-productive labour, the child's head a battering ram against the tissues of the pelvis, the bladder, the vagina, and the bowel. Until at last the tissues thinned and split, leaving a ragged hole between bladder and vagina, or between vagina and rectum, allowing the body's waste to drip out unhindered through the vagina. Not a matter of life or death, but revolting, uncontrollable, and bloody uncomfortable, too. Sophronia's inner thighs were swollen, a bright patchy red,
the skin macerated by the constant wetness, the irritating fecal slime. Like a permanent diaper rash, I thought, suppressing a deeply visceral urge to find Mr. Bradshaw and make a few fistulas in him with a blunt probe. I talked to her while I made my examinations, soothingly, and after a little she began to answer me, though still in whispers. She was 13. Yes, Mr. Bradshaw had took her to his bed. She hadn't minded. He said his wife was mean to him. And she was. All the slaves knew it. Mr. Bradshaw had been nice to her, gentle-like, and when she fell pregnant, he'd taken her from the laundry and put her to kitchen work, where she'd have good food and wouldn't have to break her back with the heavy linens. "He was sad," she said softly, looking up at the ceiling while I wiped away the filthy trickle between her legs. "When the baby died, he cried."
"Did he?" I said, in what I hoped was a neutral voice. I folded a clean towel and pressed it between her legs, throwing the wet one she'd been wearing into my bucket of vinegar and water.
"When did the baby die? How long ago, I mean?"
She frowned, the expression barely rippling the pure young skin of her forehead. Could she count, I wondered.
"Be some time before the sausage-making," she said uncertainly.
"In the fall, then?"
"Yes'm."
And it was mid-December now. I poured water over my dirty hand and dribbled a bit of soap into my palm. I really must try to get a nail brush, I thought. Mrs. Bradshaw had come back, but hadn't come in. I'd pulled the curtains over the front window, but her shadowed outline was plain on the cloth, the jaunty feathers in her hat stuck up like a silhouette cowlick. I tapped my foot thoughtfully, then shook myself into order, and went to open the door. "I might be able to help," I said without preamble, startling the woman.
"How?" She blinked at me, and taken unawares, her face was open, troubled, but without the pinched look she'd worn earlier.
"Come inside," I said. "It's cold out here in the wind,"
and guided her in, a hand on her back. She was very thin. I could feel the knobs of her spine even through her coat and stays. Sophronia was sitting on the table, hands folded in her lap.
When her mistress came in, she bent her head, looking at the floor again. I explained the nature of the difficulty so well as I could. Neither of them had any grasp of internal anatomy at all. It was simply a matter of holes to them. Still, I managed to get the general point across.
"You know that a wound can be stitched to hold the skin together while it heals," I said patiently.
"Well, this is much the same kind of thing, but made much harder by the wounds being inside and the tissues being very thin and slippery. It would be very difficult to mend. I'm not sure I can do it, but it is at least possible to try."
"It was. Just. In the late 19th century, a physician named J. Marion Sims had more or less invented the entire practice of gynecological surgery in order to address exactly this condition. It had taken him years to develop the techniques, and I knew them, had done the procedure more than once. The catch was that you really needed good, solid anesthesia in order to have a chance of success. Laudanum or whiskey might answer for cruder, swifter operations, but for painstakingly delicate surgery like this, the patient had to be completely unconscious and immobile. I would have to have ether. I had no idea how I was going to make ether, living in a small rented house with a number of people whom I really didn't want to risk blowing to bits. And the thought of what flammable ether could do, had done, made me break out in a cold sweat. But seeing the faint hope rise in both their faces, I made up my mind to do it. I gave Sophronia a small jar of beeswax ointment for the skin of her thighs and told them to come back in a week. I would know then whether it was possible. I saw them out, and as they went away down the street, Mrs. Bradshaw reached out unconsciously and touched Sophronia's shoulder in a brief caress of reassurance. I took a deep breath and resolved that I would find a way. Turning to go inside, I glanced the other way down the street and saw a tall young man whose lean ranginess struck me with a sense of instant recognition. I blinked once, and imagination promptly clothed him in scarlet. "William," I called, and picking up my skirts, ran after him. He didn't hear me at first, and I had time for doubt, but not much. The set of head and shoulders, that long, decisive stride. He was thinner than Jamie, and his hair was a dark chestnut, not red. But he had his father's bones. And his eyes. Hearing me at last, he turned, and those dark blue cat eyes widened in surprise. He cut the word off, his face hardening, but I reached out and took his big hand between my own, rather hoping that I'd got all of the slime off. "William," I said, panting just a bit but smiling up at him. "You can call me what you like, but I'm no less and no more to you than I ever was." His severe look softened a little at that, and he ducked his head awkwardly. "I think I must call you Mrs. Fraser, mustn't I?" He detached his hand, though, gently. "How do you come to be here?"
"I might ask the same of you, and perhaps with more reason. Where's your uniform?"
"I resigned my commission," he said a little stiffly. "Under the circumstances, there seemed little point to my remaining in the army. And I have business that requires somewhat more independence of movement than I should have as one of Sir Henry's aides. Will you come and have something hot to drink with me? You can tell me about your business."
I'd rushed out without my cloak, and a chilly breeze was fingering me with more intimacy than I liked.
He caught himself, frowning, then looked at me thoughtfully and rubbed a finger down the long, straight bridge of his nose, just as Jamie did when making up his mind. And just as Jamie did, he dropped his hand and nodded briefly, as though to himself. "All right," he said, rather gruffly. "In fact, my business may be of some importance to you."
Another 5 minutes saw us in an ordinary off Ellis Square, drinking hot cider rich with cinnamon and nutmeg. Savannah wasn't, thank God, Philadelphia, in terms of nasty winter weather, but the day was cold and windy, and the pewter cup was delightfully warm in my hands.
"What does bring you here, then, Willie?
Or should I call you William now?" "William, please," he said dryly. "It's the only name I feel is rightfully mine, for the moment. I should like to preserve what small dignity I have."
I said noncommittally. "William it is, then."
"As for my business..."
He sighed briefly and rubbed a knuckle between his brows. He then explained about his cousin Ben, Ben's wife and child, then Dennis Randall, and finally, Captain Ezekiel Richardson. That name made me sit up straight. He noticed my reaction and nodded, grimacing.
"That's what I meant when I said my business might have some relevance to you. Lord John said that it was Richardson threatening to arrest you as a spy that caused him to, marry you."
He flushed a little.
"It was," I said,
trying not to recall the occasion. In fact, I recalled only snatches of those empty, glaring days when I'd believed Jamie to be dead. One of those snatches, though, was a vivid recollection of standing in the parlour of number 17, holding a bouquet of white roses, with John beside me, and a military chaplain with a book before us, and standing on John's other side, grave and handsome, William, in his captain's uniform and shining gorget, looking so like Jamie that I felt for a dizzying instant that Jamie's ghost had come to watch. Unable